And we're live. So this is a Spheres reading group. We just started recording and we are here to discuss chapter 3 of Bubbles. The title of this chapter is Humans in the Magic Circle on the Intellectual History of the Fascination with Closeness. And before we get started, to make a couple of just announcements, meta remarks. We're not going to have John David Ebert on this call any longer. And today there's a few other people who expressed they couldn't make it. One of them was Nate Savory, who got a job. And he asked me to relate that he wouldn't be able to make this time anymore. And Michael Schwartz left a comment on the forum to the effect that he can't make this call today. Because of an issue with a move that he's undergoing right now. So we have myself, Ed Mahood, Donna Abadi, John Davis, and Wendy Runtz-Baker. And I thought I would get started by, a couple things. One is just a meta reflection on this conversation in relation to other conversations that that we've recently had, we in the larger sense of participants in Infinite Conversations Forum and in this reading group. And then see if I could lead that toward asking some more, maybe taking this opportunity insofar as the configuration of our sphere, if you will, has changed. And we've done now 3 calls, so we have some material to work with in terms of our own engagement with each other and with the text. So taking an opportunity to reflect on our own process or experience as a group to see if we can clarify it, improve it, and see what we're actually learning from these conversations and how we would wish to proceed with them in order for them to be most useful or most fulfilling, or to even define what our goals and desires for this space and for this activity are. So I want to start, though, by reflecting that on Tuesday, a couple days ago, Ed, Caroline, and myself did a call on the Tuesday call that I started doing Infinite Conversations Live with a fellow named Sperry Andrews. And the topic of that call was the title of it, if we were to label it, name it, was Our Being, Tapping Into a Commonly Sensed Consciousness. I may not have actually literally said that correctly, but the idea of the call was that we faced each other in this virtual space. And after some introductory words, I let Sperry guide us into this exercise that he has developed over the years, which essentially involved bringing our attention collectively to the common consciousness, the common arising between us right there in that moment. And it was an interesting experiment. We went through it for a couple of hours, and after it was done, I continued to reflect on it, and thoughts came up up until today. But I made the connection that part of what we were attempting to do there, which we may or may not have done successfully, I think that for me it was a difficult process actually, and I have some specific reflections on that call itself. But part of what we were doing is trying to sense something in common, trying to sense what was common between us in real time, in real space, in that precise, non-local togetherness. And that's really what we're talking about. One of the things that is essential to what we're talking about in the Spheres reading, and in particular in this chapter, because the theme of this chapter, Humans in the Magic Circle, has to do with the emergence of a sense of the way that we affect each other in groups, how our affects, as Solerdijk said, become infectious, and what are the mechanics or the dynamics of how that occurs and how we experience that. And I don't want to quite get into a sort of summary or a text-based discussion quite yet, but only to invoke that what we're reading about in this chapter, which is essentially group dynamics and the depth psychology of group dynamics and the maybe limitations of that, those languages that Sloterdijk presents us with in these successive illustrations. That's what we're engaging with here. And so how could we use the text to reflect on our own engagement in this moment, in this actual face-to-face co-present encounter that we're all in? How can we keep our attention on the actuality of it at the same time, perhaps using these texts and other conversations that we've been having in the forum as well? For example, the topics on post-humanism, on cybernetic awareness, on shared leadership, on collaboration, on metaphors, and the ways in which the metaphors that inform the language that we use affect the way that our spaces allow us to interface with each other. I'm interested in those questions, and I'd like to get ultimately to some fundamental sense, a real sense, not just a theoretical sense in terms of an interpretation of something else, but a real sense of fundamental questions that transcend the book, and that I don't have a predefined answer to, but I want to point to that space. And the questions are, who are we? Where are we? What are we doing? And why? And I will open it up to some reflections and to us affecting each other as we will.
Can I ask you a question, Marco?
Sure.
With all of that, what, for this session to be really useful for you, this session will be like what?
Yeah, I can say that it will feel that we've truly exchanged something.
Feel that we have truly
exchanged something.
Exchanged something. And for you to feel that we have truly exchanged something, you will be like what?
I will be like an empty vessel, I think.
Oh, you will be like an empty vessel.
That's the thought that came to mind without thinking it before I said it.
And what resources do you have, or what support do you need for you to be a vessel?
I think I only need you all to participate as you will.
You need you all, us all, to participate. Okay.
I think that's will.
Yeah. I think for me, that's very good information. So I will know what would be useful for you in this particular session we're having today. And I'm sure each of us could answer in a very unique way what would be most useful. I'm open. I need open curiosity from the group so that I can relax and be as weird as I need to be in order for me to share what I believe is best in myself, and rather than fall into a kind of defensive posturing where I feel like, okay, I have a handle on this and I can present it in a certain way. I would much rather go into directions where I don't think any of us have a very good map for this particular territory in this particular chapter. I've had a lot of experience with hypnosis. I was trained as an Ericksonian hypnotherapist, and I've worked with a lot of people. over many years. So this isn't something that I'm a novice or a beginner. I would consider myself an expert, but it doesn't mean around some people I wouldn't be an expert at all. There are some people who are much more advanced than I am. So for me, for this session to be really useful for me, I would be clarifying some of my own thoughts and feelings about hypnosis, generative hypnosis, what trance is. And if we know what trance is, we'll know a whole hell of a lot about who we are. Because I believe trance is a very natural occurrence, everyday kind of thing. You can plop yourself in front of a TV and go into a trance. That's what I would call probably low-level trance. Or you can have trance states which are tremendously impactful and create a lot of learning. So I'm open to that, and I would like to create conditions for those kinds of learning events to occur. So that's sort of what I would like to have happen in this session. And I think that, just to state very quickly, distinctly what it is we'd like to have happen, we may actually have some of that happen, maybe not. We're in a group, and a lot of agendas may be here. Some of the agendas we have may be quite unconscious or out of our awareness, but obviously we have a curiosity about this text, and I think it could be useful as a feedback so that we can look back and reflect on this session and say, oh, well, I got some of this, I got some of that, I missed that, this is the next step for me, and maybe this could be something I could contribute to the group awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Okay.
Well, that sounds very good to me. I would like to help support that.
I need the support, believe me. It's a very difficult subject. Slaughtered, our author, I think, has done a great deal to flesh out some of this. And I don't think he simplifies it either. I think he shows it how complex it is and what a complex and convoluted history hypnosis has had, mesmerism, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
Are we all in a trance?
Shall we?
We're
all enjoying it.
If I don't know if you allow me to share a personal experience.
Please.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I think John mentioned, I can't remember which session, when he talked about when he went back to ancient Rome. Well, yes, but actually I was always wondering what brought me to this group and why I'm reading Bubbles. And after reading chapter 3, and I have to also say that I went through chapter 4 a little bit, and then it shocked me because, I don't know, in a way I find some answers for why I'm here and why I'm reading this book and why I am with this group. Years ago I did myself, I don't know, past life regression, something like that. I went through this experience and I was in search of questions, the questions that Marco said, why I'm here, and I had certain fears which I couldn't explain. I did a lot of things, did meditation, did yoga, went to a psychiatrist and did many things. But then I tried this past life regression. I did it myself, and many people told me you shouldn't do it yourself. You should go to an expert. And I was surprised, actually, because I don't know if it was a real experience, because I saw myself in a temple, ancient civilization in Ishtar. And from that day, I started to read more about who's Ishtar, why Ishtar, why it came to me, would I find answers there? And when I'm reading Bubbles, I thought maybe this is one of the things that are coming my path, and maybe still years and years to come. And till now, I don't know what is my being, what is my existence, but I think my being is through you, through this group. I can see myself through you. I exist through this conversation. I mean, I believe in Gilgamesh. Gilgamesh existed for me when he met Enkidu. The moment Gilgamesh met Enkidu is the moment he realized that he is Gilgamesh. And this is how I see it. I mean, I see myself when I see Marco. this is my being. This is how I explain my being. I cannot see myself existing alone. Or that's why when he mentioned in chapter 3, this relationship between the two, and this is where you feel your being, your existence. I mean, yes, this is what, yani, these are my personal reflections on my readings and on this group. And yeah.
Is there anything, if I may ask,
yes.
Is there, what resources do you have, or what support do you need so that this can happen?
On support in terms of what?
Well, you mentioned past life regression. And
yes. Actually, I've read material.
Guilt mesh and all that.
Yes. I've read.
Seeing others.
Yes. I was surprised. I was really surprised. And then I thought maybe it was a dream. And I didn't know if it was really I went through this experience or did I succeed, because I'm not an expert, you know. Uh-huh. But I had to try. I'm a person who tries many things. So this is one of the things that I tried. And I never went back to do it again, because the experience was very intense for me, you know. And it explains many things. And I don't know, I stopped after that. I said maybe I shouldn't go there. Maybe I need an expert, which till now I mean, I didn't find. And in modern day psychiatry, I don't find answers at all. Never, yani, I have to say.
I hear you.
I find answers in art. That's why I write. I find answers. I always say that answers to us, humanity, is in art. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, many people say science, technology. I don't believe in that at all. Definitely, it's art. Definitely.
Maybe this, I'm speculating here, and I haven't heard everybody else, but I think this is a meta pattern, but I think there's a theme here about art. And we seem to be attracted to art and to science, but I think I share those values with you. How art is very central to my way of figuring out what's going on. Thank you.
You're here. But you know, it's actually, I'll just quickly say, I just said here. I just almost wanted to affirm, like, as if we were rallying support for a cause. And I quickly questioned that in myself, because I realized how contentious that argument can be between the art and what's legitimate in terms of experience and what's legitimate in terms of communication, what's okay to share, what's not okay to share, in what kind of spaces you can do that, what kind of support you have to do that. What does that mean, support, in terms of how you might be framing it or not framing it? Is it a therapeutic situation? Is it an exploratory situation? But the theme of art, I will say though, is always ends up feeling good to me. It always ends up feeling liberating to me in a way that other discourses, other forms or understandings of a sense of purpose don't. That I fully acknowledge may be a characterological trait. Somebody like Neil deGrasse Tyson, the physicist, may not explain it that way or articulate it in those terms. And he may really see science as an art. And maybe there's some fusion that we could talk about, you know, in these discourses. That's something that I think is interesting. Maybe one of the things that Solerdijk is clearing a space for, that we're clearing a space for in our reading. If we can see the discourses, the narratives, the metaphors that have kind of bound us, the binding energy. That's one of the themes that comes up through Giordano Bruno in this chapter. If we can see what's binding us and disentangle it or loosen it a bit, that could give space for a more comfortable and enjoyable, I hope, expression of these kinds of experiences like you've related, which I don't know how to interpret. I really don't. But I didn't even know you had it before you shared it. So now that it's in the space.
Did we lose you, Marco? I guess he'll be back.
I'm still talking.
No, I can still, maybe I can still hear you. I still hear you loud and clear.
Okay.
John, you're frozen. Your video's yes. frozen.
Ah, we lost John.
Yeah.
He'll be back.
Yeah.
Okay.
One's feed
so, John, if you can still hear us, seems to work as.
Okay, okay, you're moving again. I love technology.
I was moved to respond.
That's good.
Can you speak, John? Can you just check your speaking? Okay, just making sure we can
got
hear
me?
You.
Okay. Yeah, I got lost in cyberspace temporarily. Glad to be back.
Always good to have you.
Thank you.
Speaking of arts and science, do you folks know that the University of Oxford only awards arts degrees? If you study physics, you get a BA. They don't offer bachelors of science.
Wow.
They're only arts. Because traditionally in the university, there were only arts.
Originally.
There was the trivium, the grammar, the dialectics, the logic. And then there were the four major arts, the quadrivium, that was music and geometry, or actually math and arithmetics that was in there. Don't ask me about the other two because they just slipped out of my...
Was it rhetoric?
No, that was in the first three. There's rhetoric, grammar, and...
logic.
And logic with a three, let's call them... It was called the trivium. You had to do those three. And once you passed those, you went on and you studied four other subjects. It was basically philosophy, geometry, arithmetic, and music, and astronomy. And you did those four. And when you were done, then you were awarded a degree. The first three, having done the first three, you were awarded a bachelor's, so to speak. It's a title. It just means that you are an independent person. That's what a bachelor actually means. You're an independent person. And if you did the other four, then you were a master. And that curriculum of seven subjects, of course, was very much dictated by the church and the numerology of number seven. Then there's 7 days of creation and seven cardinal sins and seven virtues and seven vices, that whole seven, a lot of that played into it. But the original universities were structured that way. And when you had that master's, then you could go on if you wanted to become, which also means teacher, but it was a lesser teacher. It was the magister, like in Magister Ludi. If you read Hermann Hesse's, what do they call it in English? The Glass Bead Game. It's actually called the Master of the Game.
Can I ask you a question, Ed?
Sure.
Is there a relationship between being a master and being a magus?
No. Yes.
He talks about about the magus, and I was thinking, is that like a super duper sorcerer magician?
Well, that's a whole other ball of wax, as we used to say, but this was just within that academia. This is that formal learning situation kind of thing.
So Magus usually was not in an academic setting.
No, it wasn't. But everything, the interesting thing about it, originally, it used to take 7 years to get a doctorate. And one of the, oddly enough, then they wanted you to study for 7 years, and it took you 7 years to get through this first curriculum and things like that. Because the sevenness has an extremely important effect on all of us, all of our lives. There are very clearly delineated physio-psychological developments that take place within the first 7 years of a human being's life. Those first 7 years are absolutely critical. There are a number of educational theorists. I happen to belong to this school of thought, if you will. I think it's right. It says that children should not be sent to school before the age of seven. And at the age of 14, which is that second year phase, that second 7 year phase of life, that's when people became, were confirmed or in the church, for example. It is the, in Germany, it is still the fact that at, even though you politically, legally come of age when you're 18, you become religiously of age when you're 14. And so religious instruction, for example, is a subject in German schools. But if a child of 14 says, I don't want to take that, their parents can't make them because they are already mündig. That means they are allowed to speak for themselves in relation to that matter. And that is legally binding. And this took place when you were 14. And this was also the age that people very often entered into apprenticeships. This is when they left home, they were sent out, and apprenticeships, if you were to go through an apprenticeship, if you wanted to become a cobbler or a cooper or a furrier, whatever it was, it would take you, if you wanted to become a master, which they still have in Germany, it takes you 7 years to do that. So you go through this apprenticeship, you become a journeyman, and in that journeyman time, you travel, you wander, you go about, you learn. And on the basis of those handicrafts, the university system was modeled after that. And that's why we call them masters now, because when you became a master craftsman, you did, your final exam was literally a masterpiece. You had to, if you were a cabinet maker, you had to produce a cabinet that other cabinet makers would acknowledge as being worthy of the guild. And that was your masterpiece. So this, and all of these words that we have are words that we find in art. Because up until that time, there was no distinction between art and technology and writing and science. That's something that came much, much later when we split that all apart. And that came up Francis Bacon and the rise of science, this whole idea of finding some kind of an objective way to grasp reality. That's a very, very, very new thing. And for me, it's always difficult to separate, well, where is the art? You know, I can watch a cook on TV and be brought to tears by what they can do. Or a person who is making a cabinet, just like I can when I listen to a lecture by someone who says something that is so utterly profound to me that it moves me. There's an emotional connection to all of this, you see. So I don't have that easily accessible, I'm going to divide myself into little fragments that I can do here, and I can see this and I can see that. And so I very much appreciate this whole art thing because it is so important and it's so essential. It's actually the fundamental part of all of it. And when you go back to Greece and the ancient Greeks, in Aristotle, when he starts talking about arts and making things, he's talking about techne, which is where our word technology comes from. Because it's simply something that we do. And from that come things like techniques, and not just technology, the techniques themselves. And those are also very important. It's so all intimately bound up with one another that I sometimes, and this is the problem I have with Slotted, I don't want to take this too far away from the text, is that he utterly, in my mind, confuses all of this and goes on and on about things that are very inspirational in small moments when I'm reading, but that are so absolutely aggravating. I cannot begin to express to you folks how angry I get when I'm reading this text. It's not the worst for wear, but this book has flown through the room more than once. Okay.
I wish you had.
You know, I'm not taking it lightly, but I still don't get it. You see, but because I think he's obfuscating things that are, for me, and I understand that this is a misconception on my part, patently obvious. You see, but then again, then I have to stop and say, okay, Ed, well, you do have a little different view of the world than a lot of people that you know. And you shouldn't expect that others would share that. And then I go, okay, well, so I'll give you another try, and I'll go back to the next discussion. I'll learn something. I'm sure. Because that's why I come here. Because I am absolutely and utterly fascinated by how taken all you are by this book. It pisses me off to know that it's my book. Yeah. And I just find that fascinating.
I am curious about something.
Yeah.
One of the things that Sloterdijk talks about in this chapter is the effect of the philosopher priests or words on an audience. And he tells this whole story of Fichte's use of and his interest in mesmerism initiate his readers and his listeners when he would do talks into this higher consciousness, this kind of self fulfilled consciousness in the worldview or in the mode of German idealism and the romanticism of the fusion of or the removal of the kind of transcendence of boundaries as consciousness becomes aware of itself as consciousness through consciousness. And so that seems to be one of the things that's happening with the book, is that there is an effect. We're affected by it. More in the sort of sphere, lighter mode, and some more negative. It's a reaction. And so I'm interested in that, and I'm noticing that, and I do have a specific question to follow up on the curiosity. Before I get to that question, I'll just offer a personal anecdote to connect with yours. We're homeschooling our daughters. Mm-hmm. Two daughters. One of them is 7 years old, and the other is three. And before we had them, we had already decided that we were going to homeschool them. And one of the books that we have in our little library is I don't remember the exact title, but it's A Guide to Classical Education. And the sequence of learning, the sort of curriculum set out in that book, goes through the trivium that you mentioned. And I was mistaken what I interjected when you were describing it. It goes from grammar to logic to rhetoric. Yeah. And the grammar cycle is all concrete learning, memorization, facts, just knowing what to call things, how the world is ordered in a pre-given way. The logic is learning the rules. It's taking an abstract perspective on objects. And then the rhetoric is applying those rules and then ultimately being able to influence through one's mastery of the phenomena and of the way that those phenomena work and are put together. And so that's where the artistic, I think, movement comes in. And that's also part of what Sloterdijk is involved in, of course, as well. I mean, part of his, I think, style is highly rhetorical. And in the sense that we would mean it today, in addition to the sense of how a classicist might look at the term. But they're all, you know, I was starting to question this. Why was I was starting to feel like, what is he actually talking about? The question I have for you actually is the curiosity, because I maybe you infected me. But I wondered, we see that there's this play of affects, there's this infectious play of energies, there's this magic effect that we're familiar with through our reading of Gebser. We talked a bit about that. And this is obvious in some sense, right? But what is it that you think he's obfuscating? What is he pointing out? What is he not pointing out? What is he distracting from? That may be more commonly sensed in the sense of what he's actually talking about, or what he would purport to be talking about.
Okay. I started reading this under the assumption that I was going to be reading a philosophical text. So it turns out, and this came out in our very early discussions online as well, that this spherology is not an ology at all. It was a trick. He uses this as an image in order to to bring us in, which is legitimate. I'm not arguing that. But he's not developing a science of space. He's not really exploring, well, how does spatialness enable us to become together? The other thing that bothers me about it is I would expect from a scholar of even minimal quality. I was involved in higher education for a number of years, and I've had lots of students. And we had very, very high standards as to scholarship, quoting your sources, making things known, where you brought in ideas from other places and whatnot. Sloterdijk doesn't do that. Sloterdijk is a person who goes through making, from my sensibilities, wild generalizations about things and never stops to say, and I think this because, or other people think like I do and I agree with them. He also is not averse to simply making stuff up as if it were true and inserting it into his presentation. The first example where that came up is when he talked about Plato's Academy in the very introduction, where at the beginning and the end of the introduction, it was all about excluding. How do you get the dumb plebs out of this so that those of us who are actually worthy of understanding what's going on can interact with one another? And he comes up to this thing where there's this second inscription above the doors of the academy. Well, first of all, the academy never had doors. The inscription that was allegedly inscribed there was first mentioned 1,000 years after the academy was formed. None of that's ever mentioned. He presents this as this is fact. And if you're reading a philosophical text, you expect, well, this person's going to give me some genuine information. But he's not. And so that's the obfuscation. He admits things, but he really doesn't tell you where he got them or why. And with that second inscription, it doesn't exist at all. He made it up. There's not a shred of evidence anywhere. I've spent hours looking for things. Nothing. Nowhere. And I'm going, okay, you make it up as you go along. And then I sit down and I read this clay vessel interpretation he makes out of Genesis, where he goes, and the Hebraicists tell us, but there's not a footnote. And I can tell you, I'm studying biblical Hebrew for the last 3 years. The Hebraicists don't say that at all. They don't even come close to what he was saying. And so I'm going, okay, well, I doubt this. And I know not everyone was there, but one of the things that came up in the other conversation, and I've mentioned this in a posting on the forum, when I have people who are like experts on consciousness, like Daniel Dennett, who says consciousness is illusion, don't believe it, it's a trick. And this person is telling me this, then you're actually telling me, well, don't believe me, I'm performing a magic trick for you. But it's actually not a magic trick, because I have a whole different understanding of magic than what Mr. Sloterdijk has. I've known real live magicians. And I don't mean magicians like stage magicians who pull rabbits out of hats. People who sit down and consciously, for their understanding of this, change the course of their lives through magical acts. And this is nothing like what Sloterdijk is talking about. So I have this other side of experience where I'm going, well, don't you know about any of that? Because he never mentioned it. And the other thing that bothers me, since I'm on a roll, I might as well say it, is these Procrustean examples that he pulls out. Of all the pictures in the world to describe faciality, he picks one where there's a shit happens image out of Forrest Gump between Joachim and, you know, the Virgin Mary, and his description of the Christ-Judas interaction and faciality literally reads like the neo-Nazi manifesto that they put out about, of course, these are all ugly Jews and we have to do something about it because look at this Aryan Christ who's rising above everything else, painted by a guy in 13 whatever it is, so how else would he draw him? Because everybody knows that the Jews killed Christ. You see, and none of this ever seems to pop up anywhere, because he's so wrapped up in showing you what he knows. This is the other thing that bothers me. You know, he's always telling us, to me at any rate, well, if you don't get this, it's because you're just not the right person to be getting it. And maybe you should be rethinking that. He also did that, for example, in relation to Ficino, when he did that love story thing with the vapor flowing, whatever it was, which is one theory of how human interaction takes place around this. Well, it was a little later in Shakespeare's time. They believed that you were love at first sight was because Cupid shot arrows through the pupils of your eyes and reflected off the back of your skull and struck your heart. Well, there's no vapors in that. That was a combative weapon that was being used, but somehow it was in another realm and not seen, but the effects were felt. And none of these things, he excludes everything that doesn't fit. And he makes everything that he has fit into what he's trying to tell us. And I find that just too forced. You know, that's not my idea of presenting a convincing argument. Whereby, and this is part of what fascinates me, I can see along the way how at any one point somebody could say, you know, this makes me think of that. And you go off thinking about it. That's one of the things that aggravates me, because I go off thinking about stuff and I'm trying to be aggravated at the guy. Because that's what got me going. But I do think about these things. And I do think about other things, but I don't think that's the way you develop a philosophical argument. So I'm still wrestling with the disappointment, you see, of being told this is what's going to happen and something else is going to happen. Yeah, you can interrupt me at any time you want.
Well, I don't want to interrupt you. Very interesting what you're saying. I don't want to get polarized around this.
No.
Because I find he is ambiguous. And so is a lot of the stuff he's talking about. Can you hear me?
Mm.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm just, I cut him a little bit of slack, because I think what he's trying to describe is very difficult, and it is ambiguous, and he can obfuscate, I think the word is. But I think, because he also comes up with some marvelous sentences, I think. Yeah. I just wanted to share one. But first of all, not everyone on this call has had a chance to speak, and I know Wendy hasn't said anything, so I just want to press the pause button before I offer what I wanted to offer. Because I'm curious if Wendy is, if anything is coming up for her. Hello, Wendy. I haven't heard from you at all in all of these talks.
Hi, John. How are you?
Not to put you on the spot.
Well, no, it's just been interesting, because you're right. I listen a lot on these calls. I listen to learn different things. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that have come up just as I was listening to Ed and to all of you, you know, kind of give your feedback on what was going on. Kind of in response to what Ed was saying, I mean, my feeling towards Sloterdijk right now is he's looking at the world and explaining it and interpreting the art and interpreting human interaction and space, you know, in a way that makes sense to him. So yes, I mean, I definitely see Ed's point, where there's a lot of stuff that we know, you know, because we're all scholars in our own way. We've all researched and read different things. And there, I'm like you, Ed, I've got some certain things that are just, you know, obvious to me. Like, this is how I understand magic. This is how I understand consciousness. This is how I understand physics. But, you know, part of the reason I'm in groups like this and I read books like Bubbles is, let me hear somebody else's perspective on this. Because I know, for one, again, this is part of the reason I do these groups, is I never think like anybody else does. I will read this book and come away with something completely different than the four of you will. And at least in this group, I can say it. Like John was saying, I can be weird if I want to, and I can say some of these things. I can't do that with my everyday friends, because it's so far beyond the realm of their consciousness, I can't even get into it. So that's, I mean, that's why I'm here to have these kind of conversations. And like I said, because I always interpret things completely different than the other people in the room, I don't get as upset reading Sloterdijk's interpretation, because I'm like, okay, here's just one other guy who's, at least he is interpreting it and can explain it and tell a story about why he thinks this way. You know, I try to have those conversations with other people and like when they're spouting off about something and I'm like, well, you know, why do you really think that? Like, what's the basis of it? Where does that come from? Does it come from your religion? Does it come from your education? Does it come from your, where you grew up? And they're like, you can never get past that. They're like, ah, this is just the way that it is. I don't understand why people don't think this way. And I'm like, people don't think this way because you can't explain why you think that way. You know, give me something here to go off of, and I'll you know, listen to you for another 10 minutes to think maybe you've got something valuable. But usually they end up not having a basis for their thoughts whatsoever, and then we change the subject, and, you know, we never come back to that. So so I listen a lot because I'm like, well, you know, this is how I interpreted it. And, you know, as Marco knows, and I think as Ed knows me a little bit, I always try to bring it back towards, well, how can I use this? So right. If this is the way he's thinking about the world, is there anything in here I can take with me today? You know, when I get off this call and I walk out the door and I go to my next thing, is there any of that I can take with me to help facilitate my interaction with other humans, or that conversation in the bar with the guy who can't explain why he thinks a certain way? And sometimes I can take it with me and sometimes I can't.
Fair enough.
Thank you, Wendy. Can I add something now? I just want to be... Is this okay? Is this a good time?
Yeah.
Something that was said earlier, Ed, you talked about magic, and you knew magicians, and you knew that they had created the conditions for a real, something impactful in their life or someone else's life. I wanted to explore that a little bit further with you, but before I do, I just wanted to quote our author here. And the piece of text that it's a really a brief paragraph, I quote him, and then I wanted to reflect on something, not from my own experience, but from someone else's experience. And then we maybe leap into something else about what you were talking about.
Okay,
I hope this is for the usefulness of everybody here. The quote is, he's talking about...
Can you end the page?
So Ed's got the German edition. He may
right, that's why I'm going to see if I can find it.
If you give me I'd have to look it up.
You copied it down.
Yeah, okay. I had written the quote down.
Oh, okay.
I can find
it.
It's in here somewhere.
Just read it. I'll find it later.
I'm going to quote just part of it, and I'll find the page number for you later. But he's talking about every human organism, and he's making a claim here. Each one holds a memory that preserves its days in the mother's womb, and to which, under extraordinary circumstances, such as those created by magnetopathic treatment, they can return in an informative way. This possibility of return was the decisive condition of the new healing art. The patients of magnetism remembered a state of their selves, as it were, in which they were animated and coordinated from the center of the mother in the mode of ecstatic vegetability. Now, I think that is a bit obscure, his language, ecstatic vegetability. And I remember what Freud said about, he was talking to a poet who was, I think it was an English poet whose name I can't remember, but it was hanging out with the Indian sage Ramakrishna. And he was talking about these experiences of oceanic bliss he would have around this particular sage. And Freud said, well, I wasn't there, I've never had this experience, but I can assure you it's just a regression to the oceanic bliss of the mother's womb. But I'm gonna tell something that I read about from a gynecologist, Bernard Cheek, who is also a student of Milton Erickson, who was a great psychiatrist and probably the greatest hypnotherapist who ever lived. Bernard Cheek had a patient who could not become fertile. She wanted to become pregnant. So he put her into a trance, and he used ideomotor signals, you know, like one finger says yes, another finger says no, another finger says I don't know. And in the trance state, he asked what was the cause for this infertility. And she reported that in the womb, her mother had tried to abort her, the embryo, with a hat pin. And so he thanked her unconscious, whatever, and he brought her back into the room and reoriented her and said, thank you very much. He did not believe that this was possible because he thought the nervous system isn't developed enough to have any kind of response like that. And he had a belief system that was very much like, this is an impossibility. The woman, I think it was shortly after that, he received a letter from the patient's mother. And she said that she had indeed attempted to abort her daughter in utero with a hat pin. She had never told anyone about this. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Cheek had to then start, you know, he had a lot of cognitive dissonance because he said, well, this isn't supposed to be something that's possible, but he had to like have an open, curious mind. And he started to wonder about his own presuppositions about what's possible, what's not possible, what's real, what's unreal, what's imaginary, what's fiction. And I find this a very compelling kind of counter-argument to, I think, maybe what our author is talking about, this ecstatic vegetal, what do you call it, this vegetable bliss, or what Freud was talking about, this regression to the oceanic bliss of the womb. Because for some people, the womb is not a blissful place. Mm-hmm. And it's fraught with peril. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of biochemical stuff going on, as well as you can hear the mother's digestion. You can hear her talking. You can hear her talking to your father. You can hear... Mm-hmm. And we know a lot more about prenatal psychology, what's happening, than Freud did. Schlatter's like, I don't think there's any excuse, but I may be taking them out of context here. But I'm just thinking these are the kinds of ways I'm using this text, not looking for successful arguments, rational arguments, because they're very few, if any. Maybe at the end of the book, I'll look back and reflect. And right now, I agree with you. A lot of it is obscure. Uh-huh. And it may be some obfuscation, some mistakes. But I think he's trying to do something very big. And he's going to make a lot of mistakes. And I think he's expecting us to fill in a lot of the details. Because this is already three volumes. And it'd be a whole lot longer if he... And I think he's trying to keep a manageable pace going. And for me, my attention was very much held by this. Mm-hmm. I think he had enough, a lot of the stuff I know about, Mesmer and Pusiger, I believe is the one of the authors, who was sort of a study with Mesmer, but he was a wealthy guy who had a lot of, he got his stable boy, actually, he put a stable boy into trance and he found out he had a very interesting case history about his stable boy, because on one level it was a very stupid man, peasant, uneducated, but when he put him into a trance, a brilliant, insightful, majestic personality came through. So I think these are very interesting, that these sub-personalities that we can talk about now, every culture has had to deal with them, but they have been labeled and dismissed, or labeled and included in very different ways. So anyway, you were talking about magic and impactful experiences that you had noticed. I was just wondering is there anything else about that you might want to describe? If you're willing to. I mean, maybe something you don't want to talk about, but I'm very curious about that.
There's nothing that I feel in addition to or wouldn't want to include. The people that I know that take this approach, that's one. Marco likes art, you like art. We get very moved by art. So we would tend to go to museums, because that is a way that I would affect me, that I might affect the world in addition. So that's the technique that we use. But, you know, in contradistinction to what science may tell us, and this is why I always enjoy when you tell us things, John, because I don't find them odd at all. they make perfectly good sense to me. And I can understand how that might be, even if I can't myself explain how that might be. I can't explain how and why these people who practice magic, I myself am not a practicing magician, though I have participated in magic rites, because it is an effective way also of getting in touch with oneself.
Great, yeah.
So in the purest sense of the word, and if we take, and this is how I understand Gapes, and I think Gapes have got it, the most obvious, apparent, open, clearly visible, magical act occurs every Sunday morning in every Catholic church all over the world. The Roman Catholic Mass is a magical act. It is a precisely choreographed, sung, repetitious, focused movement and verbalization, intoning, in order to bring about the actual substantial what's called transubstantiation, transforming a piece of bread into the body of Christ. And it happens when they ring the bell. Mm-hmm. That's when you know it happened. And that is magic.
It is.
And for those who are there, and for those who experience that, and for those who go through that and believe in that, that has a profound impact on their lives, their psyches, and what they do in the world every day. Now, obviously, our history has shown that not all of that is good. It can go very, very badly. But all of those people for whom that is doing it don't see this as being a magical act. But if I were to put it in magicians' terms, most of the magicians I knew were chaos magicians. They were doing what one would call left-hand magic, or black magic, not white magic, kind of thing.
So we have both ways.
Distinctions, but these are real experiences that real people have, but they are also things that science, as we generally understand it, will simply not touch with a 10-foot pole. And I think it's the wrong approach to take, because all phenomenon, regardless of what they are worthy of being looked into and dealt with seriously. We need to take things seriously. Because you said, just because we don't happen to believe that things are a certain way doesn't mean that they're not that way. You know, my anger comes from my disappointment. I realize that every time I bring this up and I mention that, because I expected something else. My expectations were violated. Well,
okay. I wish you'd do me a favor, and the next time you read this text and you blow your stack, you underline it, share it with the group, because I would like to know what happens right before you blow up and what happens after.
Most of the time I go through here and I'm writing source, why, evidence, you know, I've gone through again. Every time I see the word sphere, I circle it. He only mentions it six times. You know, we're in the third chapter. I don't think you need 900 pages to get a point across. You see, that's the other thing. It's like, I happen to have a wonderful friend, and a very odd friend as well. But he's one of those people that, why say it in five words when 50 will do? You know, so and so he becomes very verbose, and he gets off into tangents, and I'm always trying to pull him back. He reminds me of Sloterdijk is like his evil twin.
Yeah, he can get very grandiose. I grant you that, but that's part of his charm for me. Maybe.
Well, yeah, and I understand. I understand that part of it, because I also know a lot of people. This other person, I love him dearly. He has an international organization, and people hang on his every word. All 5,000 of them, when they could have been 50, you know, and they do, and I really appreciate that positiveness that these people exude when they do that. I don't have any negativity in that moment. It's just like, okay, well, can you get there a little quicker? You see. And I spent years editing stuff that he wrote. so that people could read it. I'm going to read 5,000 words, what 500 will do. Yes. But trying to distill that essence, it's a challenge. I understand that.
As a practitioner of Ericksonian hypnosis, I tell you what got me into it. I was about 30 years old, and I was in class, and we were working on age regression. I actually had lots of experience of trance and meditation, and I was a body worker at that time. I was doing Reiki, and I was having a lot of this weird stuff happening. I was taking on stuff from other people that I was working with, and I didn't know how to clear myself or ground myself. I was quite flooded by a lot of things. So I think he covers a lot of this in this chapter, people who were receiving some disturbances. But I got into this class. We were working on age regression, and they started with, I was 30, they took me back to 25, back to my early 20s, into, just reporting on the learning experience that I had at those age. And when they hit 15, I immediately had this subjective experience, strong kinesthetic, oh my God, my right leg is paralyzed. I can't move it. And they were a little disturbed. And I was like, well, when I was 15, I was in a back brace. I'd had an accident. When I was 13. Playing football, I twisted my spine and tailbone and ripped out some ligaments and was paralyzed my right leg. Fortunately, I didn't do surgery. They were able to correct it with a back brace, which is a great benefit because I recovered and I'm fine. But the point was that I could feel that I was paralyzed in my right leg. And I had totally forgotten about this experience. Mm-hmm. Very pivotal. And then they moved me to the age of 13, right before the accident happened. And my leg was fine. So reflecting on that episode, I started to realize that the body is time. Mm-hmm. Everything that has ever happened to your body is registered. I don't know where exactly, but there's something there that got my imagination going. And I started to investigate this. And I think a lot of our disease and pathologies are mislabeled and misnamed. It's like our symptoms are frozen in a certain time and they want to thaw out. But instead of letting that happen, we bombard it with drugs. We use these war metaphors. Immunology, the study of immunology, is nothing but war metaphors. And what I think we end up doing is just either we cut it out or we try to block its expression. Mm-hmm. And that's what's causing our chaos, I think, in our social worlds. And I think hypnosis has a dark side and a dark history. There have been some unsavory characters, Rasputins out there, and the Hitlers out there who've misused it socially. But I still feel that it's a very useful tool, and it's may have tremendous advantages, especially in the arts. But I think to study it scientifically, it's a very big challenge, especially if you're working with a deficient mental science, which says certain subjects are taboo. Mm-hmm. We're not going to look at why are they taboo. We just don't want to look at it at all. And these anomalies, I think, are creeping up over and over again in many different people's lives, are forcing a lot of this. I think I also think there's, like Gebser would say, I think that the integral is already here. That's why the mental deficient is so distressed. Mm-hmm. So I think we're being pushed and pulled in many different directions. Part of us is still caught up in these mental deficient. I know I am. Almost everyone I know is caught up in it. We'd rather pop a pill than deal with all this going into regression and finding and contacting a source. I was shut down. So I'm just sharing this. That's a personal anecdote that I would add to Dr. research question about working with this patient. And what our author is exploring, because I think it's this real pivotal chapter for me, because I'm starting to get a sense of where he's coming from and where he may be going, because these are very large questions. And I don't think he's gotten all the answers, but the fact that he's putting it out there, I think is very valuable. And that we're doing this study group is very valuable. So thank you for letting me get weird.
I can assure you, John, you're not going to weird me out.
All right.
You're going to have to try harder than that.
But there was a healing effect, I think, from exploring that. Going back into my past, something got dislodged. And I my imagination really run with this. Mm-hmm. These capacities we all have.
I believe that.
Can I add something?
Oh, please.
Yes. I also suffered like Ed at the first two or three chapters. I mean, I really suffered reading them. But yes, I mean, I was just reading chapter one and two and listening to you, everybody discussing. And then I said, maybe I didn't get it. And maybe I have to go back. But the thing is, I mean, in chapter three, and I read a few pages in chapter four, I think this is where I understood what he's trying to say. I mean, for me, the word bubble, why did he choose the word bubble? For me, what I understood, he's trying to say we as beings, we exist now. I felt that he's saying we exist like bubbles. And it's very sad for me because the lifespan of a bubble, the bubble is very fragile and the bubble is, it can burst quickly. Is our being that fragile? The word spheres. Are we isolated in different spheres in this modern world? And then he tries to make an argument. No, there is the self and the other. He's trying, I mean, this is how I felt when he puts this, the example of the heart from the Catholic, the Crusades, I think I remember this when I read it. And then I felt that his argument is that, yeah, maybe we are living in spheres, but these spheres are interconnected. Maybe our group now, we are a life example of Sloterdijk, that we are all different spheres, different bubbles, but we are interconnected. This is what I felt he's saying, like in this, in his example in chapter three, that this connection between the experience he mentioned between the patient and the magic, I can't remember what he called it because it was something for me, the magnetic or something like that. I mean, this relation between the self and the other, he's trying to say, yeah, we came from the womb, which is a sphere, baby, which is a bubble. I don't know why he's using the, we were alone maybe in the womb, but, and then again, we were not alone because the mother was there and we were connected. And then we go back to other spheres and more and more and more spheres where we become more interconnected. I mean, regardless of the examples, I wasn't interested in the history or anthropology or gynology and what he was trying to say and the examples he was putting, but I wanted to see what he is trying to say. I mean, basically his basic idea is about the being, our being, how we come, how we, each one of us affect the other, affect our being, starting from the womb where the mother affects the baby inside the womb, and then you go out to another sphere. I don't know, this is my reflection of the book so far. I think I have to read it more and more and to see what he's trying to say. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, if I can just throw this in, this is exactly why I'm still participating in this, because those kinds of things get shared. I didn't see any of it. I didn't read that there. But I do believe that you see that there. And I think it's important that you do. And I think it's important that I get to hear that you do. Mm. That's the other side of it. Because I'm not getting that. So this is very helpful for me, not necessarily in understanding Mr. Sloterdijk, but in perhaps being less angry with him the next time I went across the road. Because I say it and we can all laugh about it and I laugh about it as well, but it does bother me that I want to throw the book, you know, it bothers me. Why should I do that? Why does this guy get under my skin? So I thank you very much for that, because that's a prime example of what keeps me going with this. It's not him, it's you guys.
That's very good information, because I agree with you that there's something about sharing the confusion and the ambiguity that we can now like go back and reflect on our reading and saying, this is bullshit, or he's half-baked here, or he got that right, but he missed something else. So I think that's very much about being critical thinkers and bouncing ideas off of each other in different styles of learning. So, and something about expressing it in a public space is very creative, rather than just staying in my library and trying to say, what the fuck is this all about? I'm going to go out and have a beer and forget about it. So it's a disciplined
yeah.
flow.
No, it is, you know? Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. Oh, okay, so I want to go to a point of order. We're at 1:23 my time, so almost at 90 minutes. And one thing that John had brought up in the forum was that it could be a good practice to leave some time at the end of these calls to reflect on what we've learned, or what perhaps what we could use if we're looking to get something from these in the rest of our lives. And I want to leave a space for doing that in as a way of maybe completing or closing the sphere, moving on to our next sphere, and trying to also be generative with these calls so that however the text is affecting us, we can share that, we can work it out, reflect to each other, and come to some better understanding or greater spaciousness or whatever it is that we're going for. And perhaps we haven't fully clarified exactly what we're going for, or even what Sloterdijk is going for. And I have a theory about that, but I'm going to hold off on introducing it. Let me just leave some time for that. And I'd also like to maybe reflect what I've learned, but I don't want to go first. So could we take just a brief time each in whatever way we're able to summarize or make us
just one thing we may have learned. Yeah.
Yeah. One thing we may have learned, and perhaps something I'll frame my own response to that same question in a way that lets me introduce my theory and leave it at that. See how it affects you, or how it may come back later.
Well, yeah. I'm learning. I learned something. Maybe I'm not as weird as I feel that I am. If I can find one other weirdo, then I'm not that weird. No. So that's a good sign. And I sort of want to cultivate.
You're in the right.
Not weirdness for the sake of being weird or obtuse or obscure, but let's face it, life is weird sometimes. And finding a public forum that can explore this in a way that's safe and secure, and I don't want to infect anybody with any thought viruses or anything. I don't need to do that because we already are pretty much infected. but we can, I think, find a safe way of inoculating ourselves and, ratcheting up our immune system so that we can detect a virus. Like Donna Haraway said something beautiful, a virus can't fuck you up unless you invite it in. So I think there's something about that needs to be registered, that when we see or hear or feel some sabotage going on, being able to alert ourselves to that in ourselves or in others can greatly enhance, I think, his metaphor of immunity. And I feel like I've participated in a womb-like experience here today. I even contacted some oceanic bliss. So I think we should keep going in that direction. thank you.
Okay. Well, I think I already had said that how I felt about what was going on from Donna's last comment, because that was very indicative of how things have gone throughout this conversation. I'm here to learn, and I always do. I don't have to like what I'm learning. Most of the things that I learned in life, I don't like. Okay? I also have a theory, an educational theory, is that there are only two kinds of learning experiences. I've had a couple of those, and oh shit. And I do that a lot.
That's awesome. I like that idea.
I really like to keep things simple. And then I can't remember. And these are the opportunities, because I, like you, John, I think it's very important that you can say things, that you can express yourself, and that you know that even if people, they may think you are weird, they'll at least let you say it. You know, exactly. Not being interrupted is a great stride forward, I find.
Right, and this group is great.
That's one of the things I like about this platform as a whole. You can usually say what you want, and people go, okay, he's a little weird, you know. But they tolerate it, which is good. You know, I think that's a great first step. You know. Okay, that's all I need.
I'm going to go last, I think. If I may.
That was long, yes.
That would be one thing to do.
Yeah.
And Donna as well, if you'd like to.
Yeah, I'm glad I learned that I wasn't the only one suffering in the first future. I'm really happy now. I thought I'm the only one who didn't get it in the first 2-3 chapters. Yeah.
I still haven't got it.
And maybe me. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, we have to go through the whole book to see, and maybe we have to read the other 2-3 volumes. Yeah, and still we might not get it.
Good enough.
Interestingly, you know, the one thing I took away from today, again, kind of like pulling it back to how can I apply this or use this, is I found it interesting. I've been struggling with some of the imagery myself, the whole oceanic, mother-centered, going back to that connection thing. And I'm struggling with that. And, you know, based on what John was saying and what Donna was saying about like kind of like past life regression and going back, even with the example with the woman with the hat pin, I'm like, well, maybe there was something in my own past that's making me struggle with that imagery that I'm just not aware of. Like, you know, it's just an image in a book, and it's not like I haven't seen the art. It's not like I can't picture the idea of what this is. But why does every time I read it, I'm like, yeah. And I just want to go next page. I'm like, okay, I got this, moving on, you know. Maybe I'll investigate that a little bit more. And
yeah.
Knowing past life regret practitioners, but I'm sure there's some in my network somewhere because I've crossed paths with these folks. So
just follow your dreams.
I'll pick that up.
Just write it down before you go to bed.
Yeah, go a dream journal.
A lot of information comes through your dreams at night. If you just write it down, a question or a perplexity, it's amazing what comes through.
Yeah.
I will give it a shot.
How many nights thereafter you won't sleep either.
All right, I guess it's my turn. I want to say 2 words from this book, just for the record. One is psychocosmoerotology.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to learn what that is. Is there a real psychocosmoerotology? That's what I'd like to know. The other is quasi-pantheistic fluidal physics.
Mm-hmm.
And if nothing else, I mean, you would not, encounter those words in another text.
Can you send me the page numbers of those?
Oh, that's page 223 and 239 in the English edition. Okay. I thought we just wanted to utter the words for
that. That's okay.
I didn't even enjoy it. Let me utter them one more time to really enjoy it. Psychocosmoerotology.
Yeah.
And quasi-pantheistic fluidal physics. I think what I'm learned from this call is maybe not a learning, but a question that's come to mind, maybe a clarity of some perspective that that one might take on the book. And I have to express that in the context of our other conversations, because we have previously, some on this call and who may be watching this video have previously read Gebser's The Ever-Present Origin, and we had a number of conversations on that book. We read through it similarly to how we're reading through this one. And I remember those experiences of having those conversations as being very fulfilling, very joyful, actually. I would even say healing. And by that, I mean that I don't mean that, but by that I mean that I actually physically felt better. Mm-hmm. before and after, after the calls compared to before. So there was something that happened in the spaces that we had created, and we co-created collectively, whoever showed up. We did two calls a week for 8-9 weeks. We went pretty fast.
Yeah.
But they were nourishing. They were fulfilling. I would leave feeling more energized. I left feeling better about life, feeling more positive, in general, useful in that sense. And they were, we did talk about many, many things, from including art, including the history of consciousness, including literature and so forth and so on. So it had these mental interesting components to it, but there was also something about the space and the conversation and the dynamics that were allowed to unfold in those conversations that felt nourishing, fulfilling, and meaningful. And I realized that that's what I want out of these conversations as well. I want to feel that. Now, how do we interpret what that feeling is? Sloterdijk is giving some ideas about how that could be interpreted, I think. And he's drawing on some historical examples, illustrating maybe how we might understand the mechanics of how a group forms in these bubbly ways, and how those groups potentially collapse, break down, puncture, all the way. There's a lot of dynamics that are going on. And I think what I'm learning is that they're very specific to who's there, what they feel comfortable sharing, how the collective space handles that, receives it, reflects it back. That this is a practice, I think. Yeah. And there is, insofar as we put some attention on the practice that we're doing together, we can create better experiences. And what are those experiences? Part of what I think Sloterdijk is doing in this chapter is pointing at least to some possibility that people could be in. This is what I think he's maybe not pointing to, actually. I mean, but this is what I'm looking for in it, I should say. Is pointing to the possibility of how we do that, how people can do that, not just us specifically here, but maybe in general as well, in a way that is clear of some of the limitations of the mental view, the mental perspective, the psychotherapeutic perspective, or mechanistic perspectives. But the question I have is, I mean, like all the things you guys share with me, whether it's your paranormal experiences or personal experiences, painting your shed out, you know, behind your house, or encountering a past incarnation, I don't experience them as weird. I don't experience them as off limits to talk about. I don't see them as non-theoretical or anti-mental or anti what we're supposed to be talking about. And I wonder who Sloterdijk is actually talking to. I wonder if he's talking to us, or if he's talking to some other people who have more of a problem
anyone in academia would have a problem with what he's talking about. I mean, the academics are prone to throwing people out for expressing anything about the paranormal. I mean, it's just...
So that's what I wonder. Is the part of the frustration that, yeah, we get it. You don't have to prove to us that it's legitimate to talk about, to talk in many different ways about these interspatial, these intersubjective types of experiences and these experiences of time in the body. This is not weird
I think he may have multiple audiences that he's trying to address. I mean, there may be professional philosophers. There may just be people like me who's just curious, you know, and has interest in therapy and psychology. And there may be anthropology. There's some cultural anthropology he's doing. I agree. It's sort of hard to define what he's doing. And he's not presenting, I think, rigorous arguments.
Yeah.
So I'm also like, well, what's philosophy anyway? I'm not sure. You know? And I think he's okay with that. Those kind of readers who are okay with not knowing where he's going with this, because it's highly speculative philosophy, that's for sure. But I do think there is a reason why he's hems and haws and obfuscates maybe because he's a little scared. Because, you know, he could be blasted by a lot of people. The Daniel Dennett's of the world are out there, and they are in power in a lot of places. I don't think they are a large majority of the human population. I doubt very seriously that they're having that big an impact, but they are in academia. And I look at some of the shit they write, and it's horrible. It's just really horrible crap that totally rubs me the wrong way, because I've experienced the world in radically different ways. And I've been pushed out of these groups. You know, I've been told to shut up and sit down, pick a number, whatever. And I think he's had that. He's very sensitive to that. So I'm sorry to interrupt you.
That's okay.
I know you hadn't finished, but I just had this strong response to what you were saying.
Well, that's really what I wanted to ask. I wonder, coming from the Gebser reading, I wonder if he's really speaking to the mental structure more so than he wants to speak to the integral, perhaps, but he has to work through the mental. And part of the way he's doing that is going back to fundamental experiences and tracing a story of how we've come, how we, or who we is, I'm not sure, but how we've come to limit our sense of reality to the monad, to the individualistic, to the mechanistic, to the the deficient mental. He may be getting to that, but without as clear a sense of what the integral is, in the way that Gebser or others would lay it out. And so, insofar as each book forms its own spheres of through the readership that the books create, something he writes about as well, then some readers may just be a lot more comfortable in spheres that he's not necessarily. But he's friendly too. I mean, that's the sense that I get. He's friendly to them.
He was in a cult. Osho, Rajneesh. He was a member of that cult.
Oh, that's very interesting.
I heard he in an interview, he talked about this. So he's not a beginner.
The cultic dynamics is one of the themes of this chapter. We didn't really talk too much about it, but the magnetic effects of the magnetizer and the magnetized, and how the that magnetism can subsume the autonomy of the individual, and how part of healing involves recovering what we might call a healthy autonomy or an integrated autonomy, so that one can be in exchanges with others without being subsumed in them completely, but also noticing how we seek being to be subsumed, if not in the other, then in or in the womb, the oceanic bliss, then in the ultimate, in the absolute, in God, the divine, or in consciousness itself, or how so many different ways of seeking to be taken into something bigger than oneself. And certainly a group like this is one way of doing that as well. Our individual isolated selves are relaxed a little bit insofar as we could share them with others and be received in an exchange. And so I guess that I'm noticing that we're going through very concrete layers of how we might do that, from the interfaciality. Starting with the heart, the heart space. Is that something we can feel? Right, we all can feel that. Right, and we can feel that the exchange of that. I think non-locally, the face interfaciality. That's something that is we can pay attention to. And now then this way of this effective infections is another thing that we could pay attention to in a group like this and notice the ways that our expectations around what it means to be face-to-face, what it means to speak from the heart or to have a heart-to-heart, and what it means for our words to be magical, to have effects, and for us to be in trance states, maybe to always be in some trance or another, some kind of trance as we move from bubble to bubble. How are those forces in play in our interactions? That is very interesting to me, and being able to explore that is really what I want to do. So I appreciate that you the expectation that I had at the beginning and the hope, the desired outcome I had was that you participated. And you did.
So you got your desired outcome?
I did.
Great. We're making progress here.
So I thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I have to say something to Ed. The quote was from page 247 in the English translation. I mean,
it'll be close in the German. The pages are very close this time. It's not like with Gaepser that they were off by God knows how much, but they're relatively close. It's usually within one or two pages of whatever you have. I can find whatever it is that you refer to. I like to do that because just like, you know, I really appreciated that Marco brought up a couple of these coinages that he is wont to strew through the text, because when you in German, when you start making up words, the normal, I think the everyday reaction is, this guy has no idea what he's talking about, or he just say it. Because Germans are very direct people, and what he writes is anything but direct. So I appreciate that he is writing for other audiences, or for his academic audience, or for his, you know, if you are a professor at a university, then you are primarily writing for your colleagues, wherever they may be worldwide. Germans tend to be more critical of their own, but they have a tradition that he probably was the last to experience it, though I haven't really seen it in him. Marco brought up a really fascinating word very early in our conversation when he was talking about Fichte and this whole professor relationship and initiatic. There was a time in this country, let me phrase this differently. In the United States, you always say where you got your degree. It's important that you say, I have my BA from Harvard and my master's from Yale, and I did, you know, graduate work at Berkeley or whatever. The school determines what I think you're worth, even though it's bullshit. You know, because once you get into an Ivy League school, you know, George Bush has a BS from Yale and an MBA from Harvard, but he exhibited nothing in what he said or did that reflected any of that. So like, what do I care? But if you are in that elite school, you get passed. I almost flunked out of my bachelor's. I barely made it through. I'll admit that. Because I could have been flunked out. George Bush never could have been. He is going to leave with a C bachelor's, period. You're there, you get it. Done. So what does that tell us about anything? Nothing. But I'm one of these people that I don't think grades tell us anything, because they don't. You know, you can get an A somewhere, and I've known people.
In the German university, it's different then? It's based
German
on the
university.
Person.
Yeah, in a German university, it used to be. It's not that way anymore. But when I went through, there was only the exam at the end. And you wrote, like in my master's, I wrote my master's thesis. I got a grade on it. I had to do a 1 hour oral in my major. I had to do a half hour oral in each of my minors. And those grades were put together and I came up with a grade. And how I got there and what I took and whether or not, there were very, very few requirements. There were very few graded courses. A graded course meant I had to write a paper, and it was generally pass fail. And I had to submit, before I could even go to my exams, I had to make an application to the examination office that I felt qualified to be examined. And they reviewed all of this and said, okay, well, we'll let you do that. And then they gave me a topic for my master's thesis. I had already agreed upon that topic with the professor who was going to read it. You also have to agree with them what you're going to write about. And a master's thesis in Germany is probably generally 50, maybe 75 pages long. Mine was 700. close your eyes, Wendy.
I'm reading Sloterdijk. I'm thinking this is a big book. Oh my God.
That's why. I have a lot of sympathy for people that say things, a lot of work. Yes, but I did something in my master's thesis that most people don't do. The thing is, at that time, whenever you wrote your thesis, it was announced to all the faculties in the university, and two copies had to be present in the institute where you did it, because any professor from anywhere in the university could come and read it and go, I don't like it, this is shit, you don't get a degree. Done. You didn't even get to your orals.
Wow.
You see? Anybody could do that. But so having a grade in the end doesn't really mean a lot. Werner Heisenberg, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics, 3 years after he got his doctorate, failed his doctorate the first time around because his doctor father, as we call the supervisor, didn't feel he had the capacity for abstract thinking. He's the father of the uncertainty theory. You're going, okay, yeah, how abstract can you get? You know. And the other people on the committee begged this guy to give him another chance. And he finally, okay, well, we'll let him through. But you'll never find out from a German, and Sloterdijk's that way too. He studied in Munich and somewhere, and he's in Karlsruhe now. Because it wasn't where you studied, it was with whom you studied.
Right.
And it was very almost initiatic. The professor I studied with at Gießen was a student of Gadamer, who was a student of Heidegger. There's my lineage. Mm. I have an initiatic lineage, right. You see? But, and for John, in the magus side of things, there's a whole world beside that where there are lineages, initiatic lineages of things, of what you can and cannot do, and who right. has said, I think it's okay, you see? And none of that ever gets mentioned anywhere because those are things that science and our humanities don't really deal well with. But this is how a German scholar would see himself. And that's why you always say, oh yes, they, you know, Fichte studied in Berlin, Hamburg, and in Bonn, okay? And then you can look at that time, well, who was there when? And then you know who he was dealing with.
Right.
And you kind of know what he's doing, you know? Dennett, for example, studied at Oxford with Gilbert Ryle. In the English universities, it was very much the same way. He studied with Gilbert Ryle. If you haven't read Ryle, don't try to understand Dennett. It's not really gonna come, you're gonna struggle to no end because you don't know where his lineage comes from. And that was all of these things that I found extremely rich and rewarding about studying here, because it wasn't where did you go and which boxes did you get ticked. It really meant, and the thing is, if you're going to be a doctoral student in Germany, it's not like you make an application and fill it out and they say, okay, I was in a doctoral program at an English university, and you have to fill out something and they tick the check and whatever, an interview and blah, blah, blah. And then, okay, you get assigned to these people as your supervisors or whatnot. You had to find someone who would take you. And if they said no, you didn't. I know lots of people who never got doctors because nobody would take them on. Yeah, you had to find somebody who was willing to be your doctor father or doctor mother. It was actually a birth into a new life, if you will.
Well, I just want to respond to that because you really triggered something in me. I think it's important that we know when we've been triggered, because I'm a college dropout. Mm-hmm. I got into theater and I started my own theater group rather mm-hmm. than go to college. It was a very wise decision. And I got into nonprofits. I worked in museums. I did all kinds of stuff. But I think so I'm not coming from an academic, I don't care about it. I just read anything I want to read, you know, and cool. There's no pop quiz and I don't care, but I'm very studious and I work really hard.
Yeah.
And I think that what we're in the middle of is a transition from what you're describing with all mm-hmm. of its good sides and bad sides. we were doing something else now. I think we're moving into, and I think the need for transdisciplinarity is really crucial. I know that's a buzzword, but I can be an expert in something and I'm maybe a beginner in something else, and vice versa. You may be a beginner in some area I'm expert at, and you may have expertise in something, and we need to find a way. Beginners and experts need to be able to sit at the same table and come up with ways of investigating that allows me to be a beginner and allows you to be the expert. You don't have to dumb anything down, and I don't have to be reduced to a beginner, and therefore I have nothing to say. So I think that's what I think the struggle is right now for me in these forums, because there's some things I'm very good at, and I'm an expert at hypnosis. I know a lot about this, so I can respond as an expert in this particular area. Other areas, I'm a total beginner or a novice, but that's okay. I think the important thing is, can we ask relevant questions of one another?
Yes.
And then we can start moving towards this idea of transdisciplinarity. Right now, I think that what you've described in academia is just so destroying everything. I mean, our knowledge sharing is getting less and less and less because of this specialization and this political arena that most academics work in. So anyway, that's how I was triggered by what you were saying, because I've been left out many times. Yes. I've been thrown out of the village, you know, when they were throwing rocks. And I've had that experience. I know lots of us have. And I think those inhibitions are go very deep. And we have to have the courage, I think, to articulate that and move on, because we all have a lot to share. And we may not have an infinite amount of time to figure this out. I feel we need to create some momentum. That to me is very important. That the momentum of these sessions, what happens between sessions, we somehow keep that going. Because I think I know I need a deadline. Mm-hmm. If I don't have a deadline, I'll say, who cares? You know, but if I have a deadline, I get a little anxious, you know? And I think that's a good thing about school. So if there are enough deadlines there, you sort of meet the mark. But I think we need to find other ways of motivating ourselves. Yeah. So anyway, thank you very much for that, because it helped me sort of.
We do, John, because deadlines are, if you wait till the last minute, it only takes you a minute to do it. That's all I say.
and what we do online is fun. I like our company.
Yeah, no. This is just a minute. But you bring up a very important point. I firmly believe, and this is the corollary to what I just said. If you never had any academic training or ever had attended a seminar or visited anything, but you found a person that you said, I want to look at this, will you do it? Then you could become a doctoral student for that professor without having a degree, without having anything. That's been taken away, because now we have a very formalistic system where you have to tick the boxes, go through, jump through the hoops, set some of them on fire, and do that whole thing. So I think Germany had an excellent education system, and they blew it,
right?
Because they got rid of it. The other side of it, because I find this a very interesting, which you said, well, I'm a college dropout. Everybody that was anybody in the entire computer industry, which is completely driving all of us insane today, was a dropout. Every single one. There wasn't one of them. Not a single one who had anything to do with it. Yep. Who was academically qualified. That is something we also need to keep in mind, because that's driving our entire existence, but it's the academics that are telling us how it is that it's affecting us.
Right.
And that's why I'm very skeptical of experts. But I know it's hard to believe, but I have a little bit of an authority problem.
All right, speaking of deadlines, I have another, we go over this time. That's okay. But I have to finish reading for another group later.
Uh-huh.
This is the Shantaram book, which is really amazing, actually. And I hope I didn't get to bring in some of the fiction over that I wanted to connect spheres with, bubbles Make with, but I'll do that next time.
Yes.
It was a little story about I won't even go into it. A mutant boy with flippers. Who becomes a guru and attracts this mass of followers that follows around their traveling carnival. And part of the initiation into the cult of of Arturo the Aqua Boy, this is from the book Geek Love, mm-hmm. by Catherine Dunn, is that these followers have to cut off bits of their limbs incrementally until they approximate the beatified state of the mutant fish boy. And so he has all these followers who take off, you know, fingers, toes at first, until they go through their entire, their hands, their, you know, until they're limbless. And that becomes the beatified.
Is this the Geeks? Is this the Geek?
Geek Club. Geek Club.
I had that. I have to read that.
Yeah. I just thought it was an interesting reflection on this sort of guru phenomena and the initiatory process into these, you know, spheres, and how they can, in some cases, at least as this book was exemplified, be at the expense of one's natural capacities and mm-hmm. abilities as a human being. Yeah. So I wonder if in some cases what we're asked of to be part of certain spheres or to be connected to certain lineages or gurus or what have you, is a lessening of ourselves in order to experience this kind of greater unity, mm-hmm. which may or may not be illusory, may or may not be functional. But it is interesting to notice when that kind of thing is happening, and perhaps is even being asked of us, like, what's the cost of being in your sphere? What part of myself do I have to cut off? And
that'll be an interesting topic of discussion.
Yeah.
It gives us pause to think. Yes.
I guess I did make that connection. I do have to go. So okay. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you, everyone.
Yes. Thank you.
Happy trails to you, everybody, with the book.
Been a pleasure.
So same time, 2 weeks from now.
Okay.
Back.
I'll give it another go.
I was wondering, well, are we going to continue doing this? I think we should. Let's get through the book. This is my.
Okay, I'll try.
This is my.
You can do it, Ed.
I'm enjoying it. I like the book, so
it's fairly. It's not really a lot of reading either. I read it today, and I more or less, you know, felt ready to talk about it. So, let's carry forth.
All right.
All right. See you all later.
Bye, everyone.
Good weeks.